the tension doesn't make for a very good friendly environment. Still very tense here.
Missile defense complicates North Korean threat. It's Wednesday, November 1st. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, tracking President Trump's Asia agenda. Deadly trip for Rohingya refugees. Asylum seekers and refugees refuse to leave an Australian camp. Custom cancer treatment and pollution-protected satellites. It's all on today's VOA Asia. After a year of tensions over South Korea's deployment of a U.S. anti-missile defense system, both the South Korean and Chinese governments Tuesday announced their leaders, Moon Jae-in and Xi Jinping, will hold a summit on the sidelines of next month's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting in Vietnam, November 10th and 11th.
한중 관계는 이제 정상화의 길로 들어섰다.
South Korea's foreign ministry spokesman said Tuesday the meeting is viewed as getting the bilateral relationship back on track. He said both countries recognize each other's positions regarding the THAAD issue. THAAD means Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, a system that caused heated debate in South Korea, but is now fully deployed to counter the North Korean nuclear and missile threat. James Kim, a research fellow at the Seoul-based Asan Institute for Policy Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Chinese opposition to deployment adversely impacted economic ties.
It has certainly impacted bilateral ties in the sense that we haven't seen many Chinese tourists in South Korea for the past few months. We've also heard that it's had some impact on certain companies like Lotte, which is largely responsible for the land swap deal that allowed the deployment of the anti-missile defense system here. But overall, the Korean economy has been doing very well. The Bank of Korea recently announced a new growth projection for 2017, which is higher than their previous projection, and it's at 3%. The stock market is doing quite well at an all-time high. Everything looks very good. It's just that on the geopolitical side, the tension doesn't make for a very good friendly environment. It's still very tense here. Certainly how bilateral relations between China and South Korea goes and does contribute to other things that are occurring in the region, including North Korea.
What is China's concern about THAAD?
China's official position is that THAAD has the ability to impact its strategic position in the region by allowing the U.S. the capability and its allies the capability to surveil Chinese defensive posturing deep within the mainland. But overall, I think you could pretty much say that it does impact marginally, albeit, China's deterrence capability. And so I think there's some concern there on part of Beijing about its strategic balance vis-a-vis the United States if the U.S. has the capability to mitigate its deterrence against potential U.S. strategic threats.
James, what do you think Mr. Moon's message will be to President Xi?
South Korea has maintained its current course on missile defense. I don't think that position will change between now and the scheduled summit, but the Moon administration has also made it clear that there's no intention here to mitigate the Chinese deterrence capability. And it poses no threat to China, that South Korea's main concern is with North Korea, and that it has no other intention other than that. So it would like to compartmentalize the missile defense issue and to take it off the table as far as its relations with China is concerned, but it would also at the same time like China to cooperate with South Korea and the United States in addressing the North Korean nuclear problem.
James Kim said South Korea will take a wait-and-see attitude on how China follows through with promises to enforce UN sanctions on Pyongyang, even as Chinese President Xi emerged with a new mandate from the Communist Party Congress. He said China's interests remain more closely aligned with Pyongyang than with the rest of the international community. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. The United Nations says several Rohingya refugees drowned trying to reach Bangladesh. South Korea and China leaders meet on APEC summit sidelines. Trade union says Bangladesh boosts protections for garment workers. Strong quake strikes eastern Indonesia, no immediate damage. Vietnam tech startups seek next phase. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The White House said Tuesday that President Donald Trump has developed a warm rapport with Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, even though the Manila leader has verbally attacked the United States in profane terms. A senior Trump administration official talking about details of Trump's five-nation Asia visit that begins Friday and includes a stop in Manila said Trump and Duterte have become friendly during telephone conversations and exchanges of letters. Their meeting is scheduled on the last stop of Trump's 12-day trip that includes visits to Japan, South Korea, China, and Vietnam. Elsewhere on his trip, Trump is planning to advance efforts to force North Korea to end its pursuit of nuclear weapons. But the White House official said Trump, unlike some other U.S. presidents, is not going to visit the DMZ, the heavily armed buffer zone between North and South Korea. Also Tuesday, China's foreign ministry expressed hope President Donald Trump's state visit this month will help strengthen bilateral ties. Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying said China expects the visit will promote more mutually beneficial cooperation between the two countries, bring more tangible interests to the two peoples, and make greater contributions to world and regional peace, stability, and prosperity. The tone was less hopeful earlier when China's U.S. ambassador Sui Tianke called for a negotiated settlement over North Korea's nuclear and missile programs before the situation becomes more dangerous and urged the United States to avoid interfering in regional efforts to resolve tensions in the South China Sea. The ambassador, while calling the state visit an historic opportunity, said he did not think it would really serve the interests of these countries if their aim was to sort of contain China. And he said, I don't think anyone would be able to contain China. Ankit Panda, associate editor of the Asia-Pacific publication The Diplomat, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Beijing may be referring to the pace of U.S. freedom of navigation missions.
The context here has been the stepped-up pace of U.S. freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea. We've seen four from the Trump administration in 5 months. That's a marked increase in pace from what the Obama administration had been doing between October 2015 and October 2016. But to be more specific, I think the ambassador's comments refer to attempts within the Association of Southeast Asian Nations to arrive at a binding code of conduct with China. The Chinese and the ASEAN states came to a draft framework agreement earlier this year, which the Chinese really welcomed. They see that as the way forward. Obviously, I think it fell short of what a lot of U.S. observers have long been recommending, in that it wasn't specifically binding in the ways that would really count at the end of the day. So I think before Trump goes to Asia, I think the Chinese ambassador saw it fit to send this message about the South China Sea.
Panda also says the U.S. role in Asian waters is debated depending on the point of view.
Washington has long said that it has great national interests in the region, including freedom of navigation and overflight and international law. But more specifically, I mean, these questions revolve around the broader question of whether the United States is an Asian power, is an Asia-Pacific power in the 21st century. And the Chinese certainly don't see the kind of role for Washington that the United States sees for itself. I do find it curious, though, that the ambassador would make these comments. The Trump administration at the highest levels of at least the political leadership has actually been quite muted when it comes to the South China Sea. We haven't heard President Trump, for example, talk about the South China Sea in a very long time. The last significant statement I can think of was by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, but also certainly Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis at the Shangri-La dialogue back in May, where he delivered a fairly clear statement of U.S. policy, which was pretty much the same as the Obama administration's policy. Also, I think, you know, going forward, looking forward to this trip, Trump is supposed to make a major address in Da Nang, Vietnam, where he's supposed to talk about this idea of a free and open Asia-Pacific. So I think the Chinese may anticipate that for the first time we'll get a better articulated Asia strategy speech from this administration. So they may be attempting to preempt that with these statements on the South China Sea.
Anki Panda said the second face-to-face encounter by the U.S. and Chinese leaders following their first summit in April in Florida likely will produce no breakthroughs on economic issues. On North Korea, he expects the United States to call for greater Chinese enforcement of existing U.N. sanctions, while Beijing will urge the United States to turn down the temperature on its rhetoric aimed at Pyongyang. Happening now in Asia, Thailand says it has revoked the passports of ousted Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra, who fled the country last month before facing sentencing in connection with a botched rice subsidy program. Yingluck was convicted by Thailand's Supreme Court in September and sentenced in absentia to 5 years in prison. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always happy to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for stopping by and giving us a listen. The UN Refugee Agency reports at least four Rohingya refugees fleeing violence in Myanmar died early Tuesday when their boat capsized in the Bay of Bengal, close to the southern shore of neighboring Bangladesh. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
UNHCR spokesman Babar Baloch says 42 members of six families, including men, women, and children, were aboard the doomed vessel when it ran into rough seas while approaching the shore. UN refugee aid workers and partners on the ground reportedly rushed to the scene to provide medical aid, food, blankets, and clothes to survivors.
The boat was hit by large waves and eventually capsized, trapping people underneath. Several were injured when they hit the engine. A 15-year-old boy died on the spot, and all 22 injured were rushed to hospitals and NGO clinics, but three reportedly died en route.
Baloch says the remaining 19 were taken to UNHCR's transit center near Kuttupalong camp. In a separate incident, authorities in Bangladesh say three infants drowned after slipping from their mother's laps when a boat bringing them from Myanmar reached shore. The International Organization for Migration reports more than 607,000 Rohingya have arrived in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, since the mass exodus of refugees from Myanmar began August 25th. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says new arrivals appear to be slowing, although people continue to arrive daily in the area's makeshift settlements.
The settlements are dangerously congested and overcrowded, and the pressure on sources of clean drinking water and basic sanitation are enormous. Having walked for days without water and food, the refugees arrive to the settlements exhausted and thirsty. Many are ill.
Millman says all the spontaneous and makeshift sites where the refugees are camped out urgently need water, sanitation, and hygiene to prevent diseases from breaking out. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. For the first time ever, an Asian country has the most powerful passport in the world. The Passport Index says holders of a Singaporean passport can now easily visit 159 countries, either visa-free or by gaining a visa on arrival. Germany is a close second. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia.
About 600 men remain inside the Papua New Guinea detention center. Most of them are refugees, including many from...
As VOA Asia continues, Australia has closed its controversial offshore detention center in Papua New Guinea. But more than 600 refugees and asylum seekers there say they're refusing to leave. The men say they fear for their safety in the local community and are uncertain about their future. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports Australian officials have left the facility and water and power supplies, which are being switched off.
About 600 men remain inside the Papua New Guinea detention centre. Most of them are refugees, including many from Myanmar, Iran, and Afghanistan. They insist they're too scared to leave the processing centre and are refusing to move to new accommodation elsewhere on the island. They say they've stockpiled food and water, and it's unclear when or if they'll be forced out by Papua New Guinea authorities. Senator Nick McKim, an immigration spokesperson for the Australian Greens, says the detainees fear for their safety.
They don't believe it's safe here in the Manus community for them, and we've seen, you know, multiple machete attacks and knife attacks over recent months, and the guys are in the fear for their lives.
Advocates say about 480 of the 600 men inside the Manus Island facility are refugees. The rest are asylum seekers, many of whom have had their refugee claims rejected. The fate of all of them is unclear. Papua New Guinea says the men are Australia's responsibility. But Canberra won't resettle any of the Manus Island detainees under tough asylum and border protection policies. Kate Schutze, a researcher with the rights group Amnesty International, claims the Manus Island detainees are being abandoned by Australia.
Essentially, there's no real plan here for them to be able to rebuild their lives. So that's really quite alarming. All indications around these new centres and the security around these new centres seems to indicate that they're moving them from one prison to another with no logical rationale behind it.
Since 2013, Australia has incarcerated all asylum seekers who try to reach its shores by boat on Manus Island and Nauru, a tiny Pacific republic. Canberra has said the policy deters people trafficking and prevents deaths at sea. But the conditions inside the camps have been described by the United Nations and human rights groups as cruel. The United States has agreed to resettle some of the refugees from Manus Island and Nauru under a deal Australia reached with the Obama administration last year. In September, 22 men, including those from Sudan, Bangladesh and Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar, became the first to be moved from the offshore detention centre in Papua New Guinea to the United States. It's unclear how many refugees Washington will eventually resettle. In return, Australia will take in Central American refugees from the United States. Last year, a court in Papua New Guinea ruled the Australian-funded camp on Manus Island was unconstitutional. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The leaders of South Korea and China will hold face-to-face talks next week, ending a year of diplomatic tensions over South Korea's deployment of a U.S.-built anti-missile system. Moon Jae-in and Xi Jinping will huddle on the sidelines of the APEC summit in Vietnam, November 10th and 11th. Big stories and great features are found every day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, doctors in the United States are increasingly employing a new approach when treating tumors thanks to new technology of genomic sequencing. That allows them to look at each patient and his or her cancer as an individual and develop a customized therapy. VOA's George Pudich reports the new approach is showing some promising results.
Instead of the traditional, invasive and painful method for retrieving tissue suspected of being malignant, the new method, called liquid biopsy, can reliably find tumor cells in the patient's blood. But just looking at those cells does not tell the whole story.
So the new way to get a diagnosis is to look deep in the cell and understand precisely what made it into a tumor. And that's genomic sequencing.
In practical terms, genomic sequencing involves making a detailed analysis of the patient's genome, looking for mutations that cause the uncontrolled growth of cells into tumors. Once the results are available, doctors comprising a so-called tumor board gather to discuss the best approach to treating that specific patient. The traditional therapy would have involved surgery and chemotherapy or radiation. But after genomic sequencing, cancer patient Allison Cairns was treated only with two drugs.
In about 8 weeks from a treatment, the imaging showed about 50% reduction of a tumor. And that remains to be continued to shrink gradually after the first reduction over the past year now, almost a year now.
Some oncologists caution that the biology of cancer is very complicated and that there's still a lot to learn about it.
We've actually learned in some of these situations where the mutations existed in the genetic analysis and the drug was available to match that genetic mutation, in those patients it didn't work.
Others feel much more optimistic, saying they expect tumor profiling to become standard for all cancer patients. So do patients who have experienced improvement in their health.
Boy, if you can get the DNA testing and there's a match for it, I'd really highly recommend that because it works so well.
George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
We are all very familiar with pollution here on Earth, but human-caused space pollution can range from a hammer that floats away from a space station even to a nuclear weapons test in the atmosphere that could damage nearby spacecraft. But one unexpected source of pollution actually helps many satellites. VOA's Shelley Schlender in Boulder, Colorado, tells us the special pollution protects spacecraft from killer electrons in a region above the Earth called the Van Allen Belts.
Even in outer space, people are big polluters. Each dot on this map is an orbiting object, and most of it is orbital debris, says Boulder scientist Dan Baker.
This can range from little chips of paint all the way up to spent rocket bodies.
While that debris is a problem, nature creates a bigger hazard, killer electrons, in a magnetized zone around the Earth called the Van Allen Belts.
We know, we've observed them to cause very significant problems for spacecraft that are operating in space.
Killer electrons also come from atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons.
Especially in the 1960s, there were nuclear explosions that put huge amounts of radiation into space that caused many satellites to die because of radiation damage. And if that were to happen today, we know that there are over 1,400 satellites operating in space around the Earth. And all of those could be subject to very severe consequences if we started pumping more radiation into space.
Global treaties ban nuclear weapons tests in the atmosphere. Baker worries anyway.
There are nations, for example, North Korea and others that may be thinking once again and who may not be adherents to such treaties that this might be an interesting way to mess with modern technology.
To keep killer electrons from messing with modern spacecraft, scientists put heavy armor on satellites that spend time in the Van Allen Belts. Lower orbiting spacecraft don't need that, because just below the Van Allen Belts, the killer electrons abruptly stop.
It's somewhat analogous to the shields up, Scotty, that Captain Kirk talked about in Star Trek.
Recently, Baker's teams figured out what stops those killer electrons. It's radio transmissions the military sends way down to submarines. It turns out those radio waves also go way up.
These waves act to sort of scatter and scrub the inner part of the Van Allen Belts.
Baker says this radio pollution is beneficial. Berkeley, California space sciences researcher John Bunnell agrees.
You know, it's a fascinating technology that could enable, in the future, us to explore, you know, more of the solar system with people, with robots.
Bunnell adds this doesn't mean we're ready to make Star Trek-like space shields yet, but notes that new discoveries lead to new technologies. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Boulder, Colorado.
You've been listening to VOA Asia, and by now you're quite familiar because we tell you a lot that you can find us on iTunes and SoundCloud, but we're also on the radio. If you happen to be in the Philippines, catch us on Falcon Radio at Adamson University. Also Media Biz Radio in Singapore at Temasek Polytechnic. Thanks to everyone there who's listening, and however you may be listening around the world, we thank you for joining us today and invite you to write to us via Facebook at VOA Asia, or you can send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. Our director is Tracy Carter. Our engineer is Chang. Managing editor, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a super day ahead.